guinea pig chow last year, so what would I do with $500?
This is not a research institution, okay, but I came here with that in mind. Four sons, wife from Italy, son that's a middle school principal, another son who is, he works for the Board of Regents. Anybody can deal with them? He works with their Board of Trustees or the Board of Regents. He writes papers for them, position papers and stuff like that. Another son who is a stonemason out in Livingston, Montana, where they build houses that none of us can ever afford. Multi-million-dollar houses, maybe stuff. Another son who is a second-year resident in podiatry and surgical stuff. So this is the kiddos. I've been involved in numerous kinds of activities. I've negotiated 7 of the last 8 contracts with the faculty union here. I've been involved at the state level. I've been on the board of directors of the State Michigan Education Association. I've been on the board of directors of the National Education Association. And in the NEA out of D.C., I used to lobby commonly with recently deceased Senator Kennedy from Massachusetts. We're going to be dealt with education issues. Also, of course, all the people from Hartsville as well, trying to get aid for students and better loan deals and that kind of stuff. Currently on many different boards. I'm on the past president for the American Microbiology Michigan branch, so I'm the board of directors of that. I'm the board of directors of an insurance company, so I can tell them about diseases and things of that nature. So a variety of different things. I came here to teach medical school. You teach on faculty about 3 hours a year. Generally, I do that before noon on Monday. So this is what I wanted to do, and I enjoy doing it. I've been doing it since 1977, which is probably before most of you were born. But to keep in contact, I'm regularly go to international meetings. Particularly interested in immunology, vaccines, production, and such. Contact the World Health Organization, NIH, CDC, all that kind of stuff. I know people in those places and such like that. By the way, if you're curious, there's something called healthmap.org. Healthmap.org. Really neat idea. What they've done is they've got a really bright woman from France who's a software specialist, and they put together some minds from Harvard Medical, and they've got a connected that with Google. And if you try to get it on your laptop, be a little bit careful because it collects data from around the world on a variety of different diseases over a variety of time spans. So I recommend if you do that, look for a particular disease like H1N1 or a particular country, United States, or something like that. A particular period of time, maybe in the last 3 weeks or something. Otherwise, it will crash on you because there's a massive amount of information out there. But basically, they have web crawlers that go around and report anything that's on the electronic media and sort it out to find out what the most current information is. They picked up H1N1 probably about 5 days before the CDC knew it was around. So they're really good at collecting information worldwide. It's in about 6 different languages. It's translated into 6 different languages, so you can read the Russian reports in English and the French reports in English and so on. They're adding 3 more languages, I think, in the next few weeks. So it's really a neat site, and as we go into H1N1 information, you'll be able to find out what the current data is before you hear it on the news and stuff like that. I use that information when I'm, for example, I'm on a university's infectious disease task force, and they have an H1N1 and swine flu task force and all of those things. I also meet with the president on a routine basis, and the group of faculty about 4 or 5 of us. Meet with the president and a couple members of the board of trustees to work on quote climate issues. So just keep them informed about stuff that you need to know about. So that's where I'm at. I'm busy with many different things, but what I really enjoy most is what I'm doing here. With you guys. Okay. All right, so what we want you to know about is a little bit of background first. Again, you'll see this as sort of a review and application kind of thing, RNA. So, what do we know about that? Review and application. first variety of slides should be stuff that we saw before. Now, you may not remember it, by the way. Top scores generally are D's on that test. So top scores would be in the 60s. So don't get surprised if you've got something less than 60. But just moving on to the 40s and 50s. And what we have to understand what science is and what science isn't, because you're going to be the communicator of science to everyone else that you deal with, or the general public. Okay? And also you'll be dealing with physicians, and you have to communicate ideas with them as well. And so we have to understand that a science thing is based on the scientific method, which you know about. That also means that things which are not based in the scientific method are not necessarily dumb ideas, bad ideas, they are just not provable ideas, or not yet proven ideas. And history is scattered with ideas that were, by the current scientific minds of the time, thought were dumb ideas. At one point, people thought the world was flat, and everybody thought the round was wrong, and so on. And so just because it's not acceptable doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means that in most cases, it's not been proven to be correct. In your field, there's probably things like aromatherapy or something like that. Clearly, fringe stuff. But you're going to say right away, oh, well, that's a dumb idea. Okay? That has no basis in anything. But we don't know that, you see. It hasn't been tested out. And our inclination is to turn everything into black and white, and clearly, this is this way, and that is that way, and so on and such. But unless we've actually proven it, then we don't really know it. It may be that aromatherapy is a good way of getting things to stimulate neurotransmitters, because obviously sensory perception through the nose goes directly to the brain, and maybe it does do things that we don't know about. Okay? All we can say when asked about those things is you don't know, which is an easy thing to say. Sometimes people don't like to say they don't know. They want to be some sort of deity of some sort that knows everything, but you really don't know everything, and then it's good to start off on that basis that you don't know, so you're on a good basis with your clients, patients, physicians, and so on. So basically, it's unknown, which is not to say that it's wrong. Okay. A patient may want to have a shaman down for an hour in a room with snakes and things of that nature, and you go, well, that's dumb. But some of the patients may want to pray before they go to the surgery, and you say, well, that's dumb. Well, maybe not so much dumb. We have what's called a placebo effect. Sugar pill thing. But it works. Placebo effect is an effect. Okay? So there are aspects of the way in which our brain works which influence how the body works. And so we don't want to dismiss these things. A good surgeon's often tell the patient during surgery and after surgery while they are, quote, unconscious, it went really well, Mrs. Brown. I think you'll be have complete recovery. Much better than oops. You don't want to say that in the surgery, right? Because the patient has some perception of these things. And we know that if you feel good, you are better off than if you feel bad. You respond to pain differently. So we don't, those areas which we don't understand, we don't want to simply say, that's a dumb idea. It's much better to say, don't know, but if you want to pray or have a shaman dance around or whatever, as long as you take your medication, which we know or believe it does work, so we have concomitant therapy occurring at the same time, that's probably okay. Now, if the person wants to drink, 500 pounds of radish juice or something, that may have adverse effects on the GI tract and so on, but generally speaking, things that we don't understand, we don't want to say no about, we simply say we don't understand it. And if it doesn't conflict, it's always best to let the patient do that. Sometimes the patient knows more about these things than we do. They may know more about their body than we do. So we tend to get really rigid, and we shouldn't be so rigid. Scientific facts, it's another thing. They've been written in stone, and those stones have been ground to dust numerous times in the centuries. So what is a fact? A fact is based on an experimental observation. We say a certain drug is given at a certain dose, so many milligrams per kilogram of body weight, or whatever. How does that come about? Well, historically, it came about by testing medical students. It wasn't until maybe 20 years ago we started to expand the population. So we had people who were generally 20 to 24 years of age, who were in fairly good health, males, and we tested them and said, okay, this is what we're going to use now for everyone, regardless of your gender, regardless of your age, and regardless of any other medical condition. Bad idea. What are drug clearance rates in a person who has kidney failure? Not the same as a normal person. What is the drug activation of a patient that has cirrhosis? Not the same as an average healthy person. So basically, we have to put it into context that's different than the experimental design. So therefore, the original fact is only a fact within the conditions of the experiment. Okay. Not necessarily universally applicable. So we have temporal facts, situational facts. So we can't always extrapolate. We have to be open, particularly as we keep people alive longer with a variety of chronic illnesses. We have to take that aspect of their life and their body into play. Okay? As we start sorting about treatments and that sort. A paradigm is a way of thinking. A false paradigm is a false way of thinking. But a false paradigm can be a practical way of thinking. You have no difficulty at all holding two contradictory ideas in your mind exactly at the same time. You know the world is, well, not completely round, it's sort of pear-shaped, but it's spherical sort of, right? It's not flat. You know that. But if you measure your garage patio, you put in a piece of cement or something, or if you're giving directions to go to Grand Rapids, and you say, well, you go down to Grand Rapids, and you go up to Traverse City, you have no problem with saying those kind of things, and those are linear ways of talking about things on a global world. Spherical surface. You have no problem with that. Okay. So we can use false paradigms as long as we know its limitations. We do that when we use models. A model is a partial view of the world of some sort. And as long as we deal with the facts within that model's constraints, the model is more or less correct. If we take it outside those constraints, it's not going to work at all, quite likely. Five blind Indians from New Delhi looking at an elephant, so to speak, looking at an elephant, blind. Right? And one feels the side of the elephant, says, oh, an elephant is like a wall. Another one feels an elephant, well, that's like the legs are like a column. Somebody else says, no, an elephant feeling the tail is like a string. Feeling the trunk, he says, no, an elephant's like a stable. Feeling the ear, no, an elephant is like a palm leaf. Okay. Well, they're all right, but they're all wrong. And collectively, pillars and walls and strings and snakes and palm leaves do not create an elephant. So they're all right about what they're saying. They're all wrong about what an elephant is. And collectively, they're wrong. So models work within a particular setting, but they aren't necessarily extrapolated to reality. And what we try to do is get a composite view to several different models, this model, that model, that model. And we try to get a sense of what it might be that has all these characteristics. So false ideas can be used within limitations. We know what the scientific method is. Biogenesis, life coming from life. Okay. As opposed to spontaneous generation, book, there it is. The medical implications of that are obviously what we're talking about. That is, the medical implications of biogenesis means that a patient that has an organism in their body, the organism is leading to some problem in the patient. If we kill the organism and not the patient in the process, then we can cure their problem. Okay. That's the essence of it. Germ theory of disease is just more of the same sort of thing. It's the application of the scientific method to microbiology. Implications there, for example, would be that, you know, if a look, as was thought in the 1400s, could cause a disease, and I keep wanting to buy one of these. I go to Italy every year. I have a class, Wine and Cheese of Italy. Good idea. Applied fermentation, a couple weeks in Italy. Anyway, in Florence, they have this mass maker that's very well-known, and he makes the mask that they used to make in the Middle Ages that the doctor would wear to scare the organism, the spirit, out of the patient to cure them. Okay? So thinking that evil spirits cause disease, the mask would scare you. If looks could cause disease, the curative way of preventing spread of disease would have those Georgia State Trooper reflective sunglasses, little mirror types. And so if someone looked at you and caused a disease, it would bounce off your eyes and into there as an angry disease. So we would have not the School of Pharmacy, but we have the Bausch and Lomb School of Preventive Medicine, something like that. So the basis of how we understand something is how we treat it, how we prevent it. If we think that AIDS is caused by God's punishment, then we can't do that except go pray for someone's soul in terms of treatment. Cell theory, obviously you should know the cell theory, that microorganisms are single-cell organisms. You're a multicellular organism, and cells are interdependent when they're in a multicellular organism. We'll see about more about that when we talk about the immune system. Eukaryotic prokaryotic cells. Well, we'll get to those in a moment as well, just reminding you. Prokaryotic cells are bacterial, eukaryotic cells are fungal, and animal, and plant, and so on. Of course, many implications of that are you're going to be treating, for example, a prokaryotic infection in a eukaryotic cell body. So there are significant differences between the two, and we can capitalize on those differences. But if we have a fungal infection, which is a eukaryotic cell, in a eukaryotic cell in the body, the differences aren't as great. And there are fewer antifungal drugs that don't have side effects. And then between viral infections, which are a life form inside of our cells, there are even fewer differences between a virally infected cell and a non-virally infected cell. And if the differences, which are important, is the differences between the invader and us that we use to capitalize in terms of treatment. If it's a matter of killing the organism, the virus, the fungal, the bacterial cell, killing the organism is not difficult. It's easy. We would not have any problem at all. There would not be a school of pharmacy if that was all we tried to do. We tried to kill the organism, the bacteria, the fungal, the viral, inside the patient without killing the patient. I mean, if you wanted to kill the organism, why collect the patient? 121 degrees, 15 to 20 minutes, 15 pounds of syringe pressure, squirt them off the inside of the autoclave when you're done, but it would kill the patient, but you kill the organism. So it's not killing the organism that's hard. It's killing the organism and keeping the patient alive. That's the trick. And that's why this whole structure, this building is here. If it was just killing organisms, that's not hard to do. You just burn everybody to the stake if it's dead, if it's sick or something. So viruses, we're going to consider them alive, they're not cells, but we're going to consider them alive, living entity, they replicate, we'll talk more about that in detail later. And you might want to define what alive is. Various aspects of microbiology, clinical microbiology, industrial viral oncology, and immunology. Clinical microbiology, in a brief thumbnail description, again, we're just reviewing stuff you've probably already heard before, we're just putting it in context, we'll build on it later. But basically, clinical micro, identifying microorganisms that are bacteria and fungal by isolating them, achieving a pure culture, and particularly in the cases of bacteria, we do antimicrobial susceptibility. So, you take it from the patient sample, urine sample, bloodstream sample, topical, throat, skin, whatever, and then you'll grow it, whatever grows there, given the media that you're selecting it from. So a certain kind of media will select certain organisms growing, other kind of media and other growth conditions, other organisms. So if you grow the sample in the presence of oxygen, the strict anaerobes that can't live with oxygen don't grow there. So if you're looking for anaerobes, you have to grow them on the right conditions to see them as well. And then you have multiple organisms growing. You select each one of those individually, grow them in separately. That's a pure culture. And that's what you can test on. This process takes several days. It is because it takes several days to grow pure cultures and then test the individual isolates of the patient to see what antimicrobial agents were. Because of all that, we have a microbiology lab in the hospital. Otherwise, we have a molecular biology lab that we use as some sort of DNA probe or something and find out what the organism is. If what it is was sufficient, that's all we need to do. Okay? But that isn't what we need to know. The patient doesn't need to know the name and genus and species. The physician really doesn't care what the name and genus and species. The physician wants to treat the patient. Since organisms have multiple genomic informations, a given Staph aureus is going to be treated differently than another Staph aureus because they have different genetic information. We have no way of determining that level of information without growing it individually, on pure culture, and testing it. It's a very laborious procedure. If Pasteur would come back from the 1800s, he would know exactly what's going on. He would see a Bunsen burner, and he'd see plates, and he'd see streaking with loop. It hasn't changed. Microscopes, it hasn't changed. It has not changed fundamentally. And it won't change until we have a very quick mechanism of determining the genetic information relative to antimicrobial resistance. Because that's what we need to know. How to treat the organism. Knowing that it's Staph aureus is not sufficient. We need to know from the isolated patient what can we treat it for, with, and that we can't do without growing it in pure culture, a very laborious process. If we develop a quick DNA probe kind of thing, where we just simply lyse the organism and see what lines up with the DNA probe, the annealing and so on, that can tell us genus and species. But if that could tell us the level of information that we need, we'd get rid of the micro lab in the hospital and reduce medical costs by millions and millions of dollars. Billions. But we can't. So we'll wait to see that. So clinical microbiology, isolating organisms, telling us what it is, but more importantly, how to treat it. If it's a viral agent, we use the patient's immune response. There are antibody response largely. There's serology, and find out what their body is responding to, rather than growing the virus itself. Now, there are national labs that we will grow the virus and see what's going on, but typically that's not done. Typically what's done is signs and symptoms of the patient. By the way, a sign is what you see in the patient, symptoms is what they complain of. You can measure and see the temperature, but you can't feel the pain of the sore throat. So if the pain in the sore throat is a symptom, the body temperature we can read, and that would be a sign. So based on signs and symptoms of the patient, and the serology, we can determine that they have H1N1 or whatever is going around. But we don't grow them typically in the local hospitals, even state hospitals. So that's what clinical people will be doing. It's supporting the process, providing information to the physician to make a decision. Industrial microbiology, historically, it was wine and cheese, and they've been doing that, let's see, for about 7,000 years BC. So we've been doing it for a couple of years. 9,000 plus years we've been actually making wine and cheese, ways of preserving milk and grapes and so on, and also making alcohol, fermentation, beer. We can ferment almost anything, so you can make beer in different cultures in different ways. You can have fermented yak milk if you were working with Genghis Khan or something like that. But that means we can do all kinds of things. We also have foods, sauerkrauts and yogurts and sausages and all that sort of stuff that's fermented. And we'll talk about yogurts and things, but anybody heard of C. diff, Clostridial difficile? So we'll be talking about probiotics and that sort of stuff in the course. But basically, that's what it was until we learned about manipulating genetic information. So now we can take a piece of DNA from a patient, let's say, human gene for insulin, and put it into a bacterial or yeast organism, and now the bacterial yeast organism is producing insulin. Humulin, or human growth hormone, or a cytokine that we use in the treatment of cancer. So now we have a whole new variety of industrial type people. They're making cytokines like interferon. They are making insulin, human growth hormone, and a variety of other things. And of course, the use of antibiotics, so those bug versus bug things. So if you've got microorganisms located in a certain area, and there's a minimal amount of nutritional support, they're going to fight amongst each other as to who gets what. So they're all elbowing each other out. And they do that by producing cell products. They kill off their competitors so that they can win. We can isolate those, and we call those antibiotics. So the mold penicillium produces penicillin. The mold cephalosporium produces cephalosporin, Keflex, Keflin, and so on. Streptomyces bacteria and others will produce streptomycin, tetracycline, and so on. So these are natural products produced by one bug to kill off another bug. It might be a bacteria killing a bacteria, it might be a yeast killing a yeast, or whatever. And we can grow those in the lab, and we can then produce them in mass quantity. It's all industrial kind of stuff. Biology, study of viruses, particularly their replication, their pathogenesis, how they cause disease, pathogenesis. And we're looking at how to make a vaccine. Mycology, same thing, except now we're talking about fungal organisms, we're going to how to grow them, and also how to inhibit them from growing. And we want to understand how to prevent diseases, allergic reactions, and so on, infections, and fungal organisms. Immunology is the study of the immune response to all these things. The immune response to bacteria, the immune response to viruses, the immune response to fungal organisms. Both a protective response, as well as an allergic reaction. We want to understand hypersensitivity. How does that work? As we'll learn later, there are five categories of hypersensitivity, two subcategories, so there are really seven different mechanisms of allergic reaction. Once we know what the patient's mechanism is, they all have a common treatment within a mechanism. But it depends on the patient, how they're responding. So the patient can have any of about the six out of the seven mechanisms of an allergic reaction to penicillin, for example. So we've got to know what mechanism there are so we know how to treat them. We also need to understand tumor immunology, cancer, transplantation immunology. I mean, if you think about it, a baby is really only half like the mother and half like the father. So it's only half like the mother, so in some sense it should be considered as a 9-pound tumor. And the mother should be attacking it. But obviously the mother doesn't attack it. So there's some kind of selective immunosuppression. And in some settings, that immunosuppression increases the mother's risk for infection. And we're dealing with that with H1N1 right now, and immunized pregnant women. Because they are at a greater risk for adverse effects, because their immune system is selectively turned off. But we'll talk about all of those things in due course in this course. Technologically, we have to have microscopes. Of course, we use the light beams to see things in a light microscope. What we've used typically is compound microscope. It has two lenses, eyepiece, closest to your eye, objective, closest to the object you're looking at. Typically, they can be functional up to about 1,000 times magnification. The original microscope by Valéanos was a simple microscope and was really a magnifying glass. Curiously enough, he was able to magnify 1,000 times as well. Single lens, 1,000 times. We know because he drew the little animalcules and published them. He really didn't have journals then, but he put it in the newspaper. We knew what he drew. We identified staffs then as staff now. Right? And we know how big staff is, and we know how big it would be to see it, what kind of magnification it would be. We cannot do that now. We can't grind a single lens if you see that. It's amazing. We have this scope, technically, it's a little funny looking apparatus, but not looking like a microscope per se, but it's a simple microscope. Okay? So we don't use those because we're going to see it curiously. We can magnify 1,000 times which is what you need with a light microscope. Dark field microscope, also a light microscope, the light is coming from the side. It bounces off the organism and lights up the organism in your eye. The background is not lit. Dark field. Dark background. You don't need to stain the organism to see it as you would with a compound microscope. Therefore, what's going on is that we can see the organism moving. So if motility is an important part of our identification scheme, we use dark field microscopy. Okay. Fluorescent microscope. That's the use of a fluorescent dye attached to a particular kind of antibody called a MAB, monoclonal antibody, a very target-specific antibody. Wherever it goes, it glows with the fluorescent antibody. For those organisms that do not have a lot of antimicrobial resistance associated with them, if we know what it is, we know how to treat it. There's only a handful. For those, we have monoclonal antibodies. So if the patient has a chlamydial infection, which could be sexually transmitted, could be urethral infection, it could be vaginal infection, it could be also an eye infection, and so on. You can take the swab from the patient, put that on the fluorescent microscope, and identify the organism and know exactly what to treat. And we can do this in 20 minutes. Okay. Because there's no problem with antimicrobial resistance with chlamydia. So we can identify some things quickly. We use a fluorescent microscope, which basically one wavelength of light is on the fluorescent light coming in, it's controlling wavelength. The fluorescent dye absorbs one wavelength of light, emits another. That's what fluorescence is all about. And then that's what lights up the target. So we can see it glowing. And again, for those settings where we don't have antimicrobial resistance, which is only a small number of microorganisms, we use this and we can do it really quickly. Scanning electron microscopes, transmission, these are using, instead of light beams, we're using beams of electron. And these beams of electrons are much smaller, therefore the resolution, the clarity of image, is sustained through higher magnifications. So we can get an effective magnification on scanning that goes up to easily 40 to 50,000 times magnification. Transmission, more electrons, more energy added, we can get effective magnification up to 100,000 times. By effective magnification, we're talking about the clarity of image, the resolution. We can have a light microscope that can magnify 10,000 times, but it's just a big blur. Magnification is simply increasing size. Resolution is the clarity of the image. The limiting factor in microscopy is the resolving power of the system. And that's limited to the size of the probe. So wavelengths are very big of light, so therefore we have an effective magnification of about 1,000 times. Beams of electrons are smaller, and therefore we can have an effective magnification of higher. Okay. Culture, we have to grow the organism for the reasons we've talked about. So we have artificial media. For bacteria and fungal, we have cell cultures. Viruses have to be grown inside of the cell. So we have cell cultures. It can be cell cultures or tissue cultures or even organ cultures. So we can grow heart tissue and we can grow in such a manner that it actually starts collectively beating the cell to beat for the intestine. Spontaneous generation biogenesis. Spontaneous generation, life without life, life coming from non-life. Poof, there it is, a recipe for life. And spontaneous generation is not the correct idea. And always wonder if we need to talk about this in any detail, but it fits the bill for common sense. Common sense is where most of your patients are coming from. They aren't scientifically trained. So they slip into understanding things in a different way. A different way, which is spontaneous generation based. Okay. So we have to constantly remember those slips back and forth. Aristotle came up with spontaneous generation. He had recipes for life. Okay. And they work. Common sense observation supports them. For example, under R, for rats. If you leave garbage in the garage, you're going to have rats. Now, the fallacy there is that the rats are coming from the garbage, not attracted to the garbage. Okay? The fallacy is called post hoc ergo propter hoc. Post hoc ergo propter hoc. In Latin, it means it follows, therefore, it's caused by. There's a temporal relationship between two things, and therefore there's a causal relationship. Okay? I took an aspirin, and I got poison ivy. The aspirin gave me poison ivy. I took one thing, and it caused the other. Obviously, it didn't. Okay? But it seems like it could, and that's the logical fallacy. And patients will come from that point of view often. They will tell you that they took a drug and had an adverse effect. They won't necessarily tell you that they also drank five pints of alcohol at the same time. Okay. Francisco Riti, an Italian, disputed the idea, and you can see that this idea stuck around for 2,000 years. So it wasn't an easy one to die, and it still exists today if people don't think critically. And many times we have scientists who do not think critically sometimes. And the average person often doesn't think critically. We have to get you to think right. Okay. So see you again on Thursday.